This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It is a Tuesday, and you know, as we normally do on Tuesdays, it is the Academic Digest. And today we're speaking to Yulandri Apesami, who is joining us in studio. Thank you so much for joining us and welcome. I have to say that she's very colorful, eh? So in a dissertation, she writes that when she went to go and meet one of the respondents in her dissertation, this lady that she was supposed to meet at the temple had disappeared, and she was nowhere to be found, only to find out that at a later stage her grandma then told her that, hey, listen, actually the auntie said that because your hair was pink she couldn't speak to you. Yulandri, welcome, and welcome to Power Talk.
Thank you so much, Aldrin. And yes, yeah, that is in fact, yeah, what happened.
That's a, yeah, in fact what happened. But you love color.
I do. Listen,
I'm one of those people as well. Eh? I'm a lover of color, but I don't think that I'll dye my hair. Your hair color now is what? Purple?
Yes.
It's purple. Yeah. And her notebook is purple?
Purple is my power color this year.
Purple is the power color. Welcome to Power Talk.
Thank you.
So quickly tell us about where you're from, and what is it about this particular topic that you wanted to delve into that really sparked a, I don't know, level of interest in you, that you felt that this is something that I need to look into. And for me, as I was saying earlier on during the open line as well, guys, is that I feel like it's a conversation that we can even open up, and we don't have to limit it to just speaking about Hinduism and caregiving of people, women especially, who are survivors of abuse, but just in general, institutions of religion and the mechanisms that they have in place to deal with women and how to help women who are survivors of abuse. And of course, Yulandri is not an expert in the religious space at all. We're not saying that, but let's just have this conversation, but based of course on how she'd anchored her topic.
Okay, so a little bit about me. I'm actually from the site of research, which is Verulam. Mm-hmm. Both of my parents are from there, and we kind of have a long history of being removed from other areas of KwaZulu-Natal to kind of a forced settlement in Verulam. So, mm-hmm, as part of the Group Areas Act. Yeah. So there's a long kind of ancestry that I hold in Verulam. However, with my father's work, we moved to Mpumalanga. Mm-hmm. So I spent my high school, primary school there, and I was always kind of going in between these two places, which are quite different. Mm-hmm. And this research came about, I think, because of the movement between those two places. And mm-hmm, I was always very interested and fascinated by the temple, the Sri Siva Subramania Alayam. And it's a place that my grandfather was the temple committee chairperson of. It's a place that my parents got married at, and mm-hmm, I kind of, as a child, was very fascinated by the different languages that were spoken. So it was Tamil, and Mpumalanga, mm-hmm, you're not hearing Tamil.
Yeah.
As well as the religion itself. So this research kind of came from that curiosity, as well as a child and as a teenager, kind of being in the kitchen with the woman and hearing stories of abuse, and hearing stories of women asking other women for advice and for help, and, oh, your husband does this, my husband does this too. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally got the opportunity to do my master's, I was really interested in how, looking at kind of the importance of the temple and trying to understand how spirituality could factor into narratives of healing,
yeah,
for domestic violence survivors.
Yeah. And I'd love from our listeners as well, as we did during the open line as well, to share their experiences when it comes to being in an abusive relationship, and how that relates to your spirituality and your understanding of if there is indeed a spiritual being out there. How do you then relate to that spiritual being? And then on top of that, there are institutions, religious institutions, and what's your understanding of what religious institutions should be doing and what they are not doing? Okay, so you then went to, you went back to Verulam, and you then spoke to, was it three or four?
It was three.
Three, yes. Mm-hmm. You spoke to three respondents. Just quickly tell us about them and tell us about their stories. But I also want us to then, as you relate the story, first introduce your respondents. Take us, we'll then go a few years back into how Indians arrive in South Africa, because I think that is a fundamental part to this particular conversation.
Okay, so the respondents I interviewed, they're all anonymous, so the names that are in my research are kind of, I've just generated, but these were women who I met at the temple, who have been going to the temple quite a lot. So Rajeshwari, it's not her real name, is actually a family connection. She's a relative of mine. And Muruga Lakshmi is, she turned 82 this year.
And so at the time when you're writing this, she was turning 80, I think. Yes. Or she had just turned 80.
Yes, yeah. So my respondents fell on, I guess, the kind of older age bracket. And I found that quite interesting as well, because coming into the research, I was trying to have kind of a blank slate, you know, of who my potential respondents could be. And I realized through doing these interviews with these two women that it was only once the kind of immediate threat of not being in a marriage with an abusive partner anymore had lapsed, so their partners had passed away, that they felt that they could even speak to me about these things. So obviously, younger women or people who are still in marriages or in relationships with their abusive partners kind of excluded themselves. So they were like,
Why do you think that was?
Well, the community is very small, and I do feel like even being seen talking to me, because I was the person kind of raising issues of abuse and domestic violence and intimate partner violence within the community, could be seen as something that could threaten a victim's safety.
Yeah.
So it was interesting that I kind of ended up interviewing what would be kind of quote-unquote be called temple aunties. So these are women who you'd always see at the temple, who have passed like childbearing age, I would say. And they're there, they're always there with like festivals, cleaning up the temple, doting on the young children, kind of being a little bit cantankerous. And so kind of growing up knowing those women, it was interesting to get a sense of the interiority of their lives, things that they had actually experienced and survived, and just their own narratives and stories behind the kind of stereotype of being a temple auntie.
Do you think that if they were still in marriages, if their husbands were still alive, that they would have spoken to you?
Honestly, I can't say, but I do think they would be a lot more cautious about their movements around me and whether other people in the community saw them talking to me or just kind of relating to me. And I do think that I wouldn't have gotten the responses I would have if they were with their abusive partners.
And then in terms of young respondents, because that's something that I found quite interesting as well, and I even took took down notes and said that if you listen to some of your respondents, well, at least all of them, there is nowhere where they speak about what they are teaching young girls or even their sons, because they have children. Yeah. So I don't know. Is it a case that speaking about gender-based violence is seen to be taboo? It is conversations that you can't have openly?
So what I think is happening is kind of on a larger level than looking at the particular issue of gender-based violence. So the meetings that I did sit in with the Temple Committee, just as kind of participant observation, getting a sense of who is it that is directing and leading the Temple congregation, there was a big issue about a kind of crisis in that young people were not coming to the Temple. So you would find children to the age of maybe, 5 or 6 would mm-hmm. be coming with their parents. But mm-hmm. once they kind of get a bit older, teenagers, they're not coming to the temple anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think, and also like in your early 20s, no one was really at the temple so much. So I think that was the kind of larger issue at play. And then also when we do dig into it, speaking about issues of abuse, speaking of issues of gender-based violence, are seen as outside of the purview of that organized religious space. Mm-hmm. How, even though there are high instances of it happening, there are people who are abusers and also have been abused that worship at the temple.
Yeah. I think, what's her name again? The 82-year-old.
Oh, Murugan Lakshmi.
She spoke about when her husband, I think her husband, who was a drunk, mm-hmm. beat her up, mm-hmm. Once tossed a paraffin stove at her, mm-hmm. and she jumped out of the window. But the response from the temple was almost a case of, this is a domestic issue. Mm-hmm. So the temple or the leaders of the temple wouldn't necessarily get involved.
Mm. So this is kind of, I think, where care comes into the discussion as well. So I was trying to figure out what are the relationships of care here? How do we provide care, and who gets care, and for what?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the temple conceptualized of that was that right now, they that is outside of their jurisdiction. However, in the past, that used to be part of what they did. And I think it was maybe around the 70s, 60s and 70s, where temple committee members actually would facilitate mediations mm-hmm. when it had come to their attention that there was issues of abuse happening, or there was domestic violence or something. And so they would try to mediate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as time went on, and seeing that these things are still an issue, maybe people didn't want it, they realized actually this is a private issue, and they took the kind of normative understanding of gender-based violence and mm-hmm. domestic violence that it happens in the house, it stays in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the mentality they brought with them, to now.
Is it patriarchy?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. I definitely think it's patriarchy. And I mean, even a lot of the researchers I was drawing on elaborated on how temples function as patriarchal institutions and kind of organized religious spaces function as instruments of patriarchy. So it was really important to me to speak to the women in the space and speak to the people who are marginalized in the space
mm-hmm.
to understand how people are existing in this environment. Like, could you get anything beneficial from it? Was it just a complete erasure and dismissal? What's happening?
Okay, so is that on the basis of, I think it's, I'm just trying to find the page here, where you speak of, you have Indians who migrated to SA, so mm-hmm. now they're in SA,
mm-hmm.
so of course you'll have the migration of the religion as well, the norms and standards that are being set up on the basis of what we can remember. And those norms and standards are normally being dictated by those who have money, those who fund the building of the temple. Yeah, just expand a bit for us on that.
Okay. So firstly, thank you for bringing that up. Indenture mm-hmm. and the indentured labor system, I kind of think of as one of the backbones of the research. And it's also something that kind of isn't as widely visible or kind of in our public discourse, I think, as much as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So the system of indenture was from 1860 to 1911, and it was part of the British colonial system.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a forced displacement. People were kidnapped, people were stolen, people who felt like they had transgressed the social norms in South Asia felt like their only kind of outlet was to travel across the sea, which is, in indenture studies we kind of call the Kalapani, which is the black waters.
Mm-hmm.
And through that process, as you say, the religion changed as well.
Yeah.
So the Hinduism that is practiced in the temples, at least where I was, and that have a strong indenture background, kind of synthesize both being here and like what is available here, what can we do here in KwaZulu-Natal.
Mm.
And if you were to, you can't just easily transpose the Hinduism in India to the Hinduism here.
Yeah.
And as you say, it is about who had the money to build the temples.
Mm-hmm.
And usually those would be men who had somehow accrued some finances, were shopkeepers or traders. And in that way, the kind of a good moral kind of family were brought into the temple structures.
Yeah.
So the temple also then functioned as a site of respectability as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Okay, so I have it. It's page 38. This is not to say that... just scroll up a bit. Okay, it says standardization process. This what's happening?
Sorry.
Okay. This standardization process came with the reinscribing patriarchal values into Hindu communities. This is not to say these moral codes were not there before, but that in the absence of laws pertaining to, this is now speaking about how we speak about the new family characteristics under Hinduism and under the indentured communities who now live in South Africa. This is not to say that the moral codes were not there before, but then in the absence of laws pertaining to marriage, for example, women were not beholden to the same respectable standards that were in the 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
Just expand on that.
Okay, so basically what we're talking about here is kinship and family formations.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which the temple was a linchpin in kind of standardizing that.
Mm-hmm.
So when the indentured laborers first came to South Africa, the British colonial officials didn't see a kind of settled post-indentured population. And so there were no laws that had anything to do with regulating kinship. So marriage, divorce, birth,
mm-hmm.
all of those kinds of things. And in the absence of those laws, what you would find is that a lot of indentured femmes and women would engage in sex work, either to get rations because women were not the kind of referent of getting rations on the plantations.
Yeah.
Men were. And so they would have multiple romantic and sexual partners and kind of create families in that way.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was a kind of, there was extremely high levels of both suicide, gender-based violence, intimate partner violence. And so even the colonial officials were like, what's happening here? We need to have a commission because
mm-hmm.
our plantation workers are either killing themselves or killing each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't have this. And so they had like commissions into it and then tried to reinscribe a kind of moral family where there's a mom and a dad and
mm-hmm.
a few children
mm-hmm.
so to kind of lessen gender-based violence. But however, what you would find is that the kind of patriarchal understandings of a patrilocal family would be kind of embedded and stamped onto the way in which ex-indentured then formed
mm-hmm.
families and what
mm-hmm.
you'd even find today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're referring to the, is it the Cooley Commission?
Yes, the Cooley Commission and sure. the Rye Commission.
Yeah. So, do you think at all that one of the main reasons for the abuse that Indian women suffered at the time was because of the idea that in terms of the demographics, you had more males compared to females, and because of that, it's almost a battle?
I mean, I do think because of the kind of gender imbalances
yeah.
that were happening, that's definitely a reason for that. And I think the fact that these women came across the Kalapani and were vulnerable to both capitalism, they were vulnerable to white colonial plantation owners, and they were also vulnerable to their fellow shipmates, the men who were on board, who were also confused and kind of struggling to make meaning of, you know, whatever was happening. I definitely think that kind of increased the levels.
Why would that create tension?
Well, because already women are seen as less than. They were seen as inferior. They were not the referent of who was getting rations. And that placed them in a really vulnerable position. And I think in Hinduism, there are kind of stories that imbue certain social messaging of like how a good woman should be. So, for example, Lord Shiva's consort, Parvati, is always seen as a very fair-skinned individual, very submissive, and kind of toeing the line to what Lord Shiva says. And so I think there are also ways in which the male indentured laborers were kind of searching for some kind of meaning and kinship. And when their women, who they see as their women, were acting out of turn by sleeping with other men because they needed kind of economic stability in that way, they would see it as a direct threat to them and then act out.
But even though there's no lawful marriage?
So at various points, there was lawful marriage, and then also divorce came into the picture, but much later on. So it was already when these kind of gender relations had solidified and settled in a way that then those regulations came into play.
Okay, so when we come back, something that I want to touch on as well is when you speak about the goddesses, for instance, and I wondered about this, that if there is this religious belief in goddess, which would be female, why is it then that men would treat women the way that they treat women and abuse women? And on page 38 as well, you speak about homemaking, mothering, and religious teachings were all seen as roles of the good Indian women to possess in South Africa, and most likely the diaspora over. Just quickly on that.
Okay, well, firstly, patriarchy. The thing with the goddesses, there was something that I was also kind of puzzling through and thinking about myself. But understanding the way that power works, there's a huge difference between me as a woman that you will meet in real life and goddess Parvati or goddess Saraswati that you are worshipping in the temple or in your house. And then also when it comes to kind of homemaking and women being kind of foot soldiers of carrying culture and carrying tradition, I mean, that's something you still see today in South African Indian households of this kind of strong emphasis of women's labor, not only being cleaning and whatever in the house, but also teaching children about, you know, the religion about Hinduism.
I think there's also a part where you speak about I think it's a friend or a colleague of yours who said that Indian women are so submissive. We'll unpack that just after 11:30. It's time for Power News Headlines.
Aldrin Sampier, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
And we'll be taking your calls as well on 0861-987-000 in conversation with Yulandri Apasami, speaking about her dissertation and looking into the Hindu temple and Hinduism in relation to abuse suffered by Hindu women and the care that's being given by the temple, or probably lack of care being given by the temple. 0861-987-000. And as I said earlier on as well, that we don't have to confine the conversation to just Hinduism, but in your own personal religious spaces as well, what has your experience been like? And Yulandri, we were speaking earlier on about Indian women being seen to be submissive. So here it is, that line in your dissertation. It says, I had experienced non-Indian people casually ask me, in fact, abuse does happen in Indian families because your women are so submissive. or does abuse happen in Indian families because your women are so submissive? First of all, how dare the person uses such a phrase, first of all. How did you respond to that, number one? And number two, let's unpack that idea of people seeing Indian women as being submissive.
Yeah, so that statement was made actually when I was trying to still conceptualize this research. And I think the thing that particularly stung me about that was a kind of foreclosure of the possibility of pain and of hurt because of a very racist orientalist stereotype of what people from of South Asian ancestry do or feel or what happens in our households. And so I thought it was an important kind of moment to highlight why this research is actually necessary, because these kinds of understandings of people from South Asian ancestry continue to exist and circulate amongst us. So I really wanted the thesis to kind of disrupt notions of Indian womanhood as submission only.
Yeah. Mm. And earlier on, off air, you described yourself as a feminist. And I wonder whether that finds expression at all in Hinduism.
Interesting. I do think that there are Indian feminists on the subcontinent within India and Sri Lanka and Pakistan, Bangladesh, who are making those incursions into Hinduism and making those kinds of disruptions to patriarchal understandings of Hinduism. And the way that I kind of, I don't want to say reconcile, but kind of think of myself as a Hindu woman as well as a feminist is actually by reading the text closely. So reading the Bhagavad Gita closely, as well as kind of understanding that, I mean, like earlier on, you were talking about the goddess and feminine.
Yeah.
And at various points, for example, Lord Shiva is seen as both masculine and feminine and is seen as a combination of those energies. Mm. So I feel like there is strong kind of radical readings and understandings you can make of stories told in Hinduism.
Then at which point does this idea of Indian women being submissive then come into play?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's really a function of Orientalism and also the way in which kind of colonialism and apartheid built upon that, of kind of firstly being a minority. So there's not a lot of, you know, people of South Asian ancestry all over the country. But however, where we are, it's kind of like, oh, we'll stay to ourselves, we'll stay in our areas. And then that was also kind of the success of apartheid,
for
kind of just making sure certain people were staying in certain areas. And I think also it's a resident of being honest and open about what is actually happening within the family. And if you look at indenture in particular, how significant and important it was to have a family and to form those kinds of kinship relationships, I guess it becomes something that you want to protect even more. So that could potentially be a reason for not wanting to talk about stuff that happens in the private domestic sphere. But yeah.
Did you get a feeling at all from your respondents that they felt that as an Indian woman who's a Hindu, that we are seen to be subhuman?
That's not necessarily the lexicon they would use.
Yeah.
But I do think there was a level of being confused that I was interviewing them, firstly. They were like, why do you want to talk to me? I'm just an old lady. Yeah, I just come to the temple.
Was the one lady kept on referring you back to the men.
The men, yes. She kept on referring me back to the men. So I don't know if that could kind of link to feeling that she was not kind of an agent and kind of worthy of intellectual thought, of critical thought, of feminist thought even. And I mean, like, even though they may have come into it thinking that way, by the end of our interviews, it was a different story.
So probably not not a feeling of subhuman, but a feeling of I am not an authority to speak on this.
Yes, yes.
Probably
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Okay. 061-987-000. Let's go to Nina in Craig Hall. Good morning, Nina.
Good morning. How are you and your guest?
Good, good.
You know, just a point in terms of what you've just spoken about. All forms of racism attempt to make victims subhumans. That's how it's so easy to have genocide. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your point is not inaccurate in the sense that that is a model that is used, and it's been used across the world for genocides or the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
It's to make people subhuman. But there is a difference between being subhuman and being a secondary citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So the question that I want to ask your guest, just because I'm hoping we won't sort of miss the opportunity, has got to do with two things. I think to give a broader context, if she contextualized what was happening in the community she studied in the global context, where, of course, there is now the attempt to address women's rights more comprehensively because there is a global voice in a way.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I found, you know, a TED talk from January 2015 by a co-founder of something called No Country for Women, which is an organization dedicated to fighting institutionalized rape culture in India. So there has been that shift globally. And I'm wondering, but of course, I mean, most women, and in different contexts, it's more expressed, are subject to cultural norms which are going to stigmatize them and, in fact, ostracize them if they fight the operating system. So I'm wondering how, you know, how she understood that with the people that she was working with, and how she understands it in the broader context of what the possibilities are. For instance, in terms of this desperation, and I'm talking about it in all communities, not just the community she's studying, but the desperation to maintain family, even if it means that women will be totally abused and, of course, murdered. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, Nina. Sure. Yeah, the desperation to maintain family.
Thank you so much for that question, Nina. Firstly, I will definitely check out No Country for Women.
Yeah.
That was what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of unpack the kind of global context of these things happening, the women I spoke to in particular were not connected to the internet. They were all using kind of home phones, and maybe one of them was using WhatsApp. And so they're kind of linkages and connections and their world outside of Verulam was not necessarily expanded, especially into kind of like the feminist education or kind of what's happening globally in that way. So they were not tuned into the conversations in that way because they were very focused and, you know, experts of their life in Verulam. And then the kind of desperation to maintain a family is such an important point, and I'm really glad you brought that up. And it was definitely something through interviews that came out as quite a strong issue. It came out as something like, I don't want my children to come from a broken home.
Yeah.
I don't want...
So strange how brokenness, the definition of brokenness is dependent on whether the family sticks together.
Yes.
Even though there's abuse or not, even though the other partner goes to bed with a scar, with, I don't know, a bleeding lip, lower lip, or scarred lower lip. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also think kind of a mutual concern was economically.
Yeah.
These women were relatively dependent on their abusive partners for household finances, for putting their children through school. And when they tried to be economically stable themselves, their partners put an end to that very quickly.
The idea of, well, these women wouldn't be part of, you know, mainstream media. They wouldn't be part of what's happening on social media and what's happening on the internet. I was very intrigued by Muru Galushkni. I hope I pronounced that
nearly
correctly.
There. Murugan Lakshmi.
Muruganlakshmi.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was intrigued by her experience when it came to a menstrual cycle. When she said that when she started her period, her grandmother told her father that she felt ill and couldn't go to the temple. But her father insisted that she went to the temple, and indeed she wanted to do so. So she followed his instruction. He said, "Why can't she come to the temple? God created it. She must have a bath and just come. I went. Today I'm telling the story. Only if those ladies know, they would kick me out. They would kick me out today too. It's a sin to go." So number one, here you have a man, her father saying that, no, she's going to go. But you have the grand saying that, this is against the rules of the temple. And she also goes further to say that even today, if the aunties from the temple knew that I did this, they would say, they would kick me out.
So I included that kind of, and that story, because it was so powerful to me as somebody who menstruates and is not allowed to go to the temple or take part in prayers because of that very natural thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And it speaks also to the patriarchal nature of the temple itself and how it's been structured. And I do think that the fact that she felt that even today she couldn't tell people speaks to the kind of culture that has been created over years in the temple. It's still pretty deep, the menstruation. Because
I remember a couple of months ago, we were speaking about ZCC, and someone tweeted and said that, you know, that when it comes to ZCC, that when the woman is going through her menstrual cycle, that she's not allowed to, I think she's not allowed to go to church, and she's not allowed to sleep with her husband. So those type of things for me, when it comes to religion, is that, so is religion then telling us that, hey, listen, woman, because you are going through this process, which you didn't call upon yourself, based on that, we are saying that, hey, listen, you can't be part of today's service.
And I mean, I can't speak from ZCC, but in Hinduism, it is a thing of you're seen as dirty, you're seen as unclean,
yeah.
And so you cannot worship a divine being when you are dirty, basically. And one more thing about that story is that her father was the one to say, if she wants to come, she must come.
Yeah.
She must do it.
Yeah.
However, it was her grandmother who was like, no,
yeah,
we're not doing this. And then that goes back to women in the household being responsible for nurturing and protecting traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So what are these traditions, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was the father who was disrupting that notion of menstruation is fine. Just come. If you want to pray, do it.
Would it then be fair to say that women then further entrench these ideas, these patriarchal ideas that define what happens in the temple?
I definitely think they can.
Yeah.
And one of my respondents who spoke from the side of being on the temple committee voiced opinions that were kind of shaming of domestic violence survivors. So I feel that a sense of internalized patriarchy and wanting to be respectable and maintain good moral Hindu values can definitely be, you know, a symptom of patriarchy.
Actually, I have a tweet here from Jax Israel who says, it is true, actually, ZCC does not allow you to go to church for 7 days after menstrual cycle. Men made the law, have oppressed those who love God and fellowship. So I wonder how do we then disrupt these ideas that there are moments where women are not allowed to be part of the church? Because which is a bit interesting for me is that your dissertation doesn't necessarily look at the religious background of the abusers in this case.
So it was quite difficult for me to get any kind of information on mm-hmm. the abusers because they had both passed away.
Yeah.
And I also, through the course of interviewing, it was such a vulnerable and raw place for my wonderful research participants to be in. I mm-hmm. didn't want to push them any further to kind of either re-trigger themselves or re-victimize them through yeah. the interviewing process. And so I thought, just for the purposes of the research, we don't need to go, you know, to those places if mm-hmm. they don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Okay, so here's another interesting bit for me, and this is just the whole idea of being part of a religion and going to the temple, well, every day or every now and then they go to the temple, but they are still, their faith is still in the temple, even though one of your respondents mentioned that what the leaders of some of the committees are doing, they do not necessarily agree with it, but they still go to the temple, and this then speaks about their faith. And earlier on during the open line, I was asking about how do people, especially women who go through abuse, I'll make an example, Christian example right now, that you would pray and say, God will fix this. And one of your respondents also said that God has put it right. And this is in reference to her husband dying. I don't know whether that was a cause of, I'm now at ease, that he's no longer there, but God has put it right.
Mm, mm.
So there's no disruption to their faith.
Yes.
And that for me is so strange.
Mm, it was very strange for me as well, because mm-hmm. I'm just like, if I was treated this way, worshiping at this temple, I would just want to leave and not, you know, turn around. But it's much more complicated than mm-hmm. that. And I feel like we all make compromises living under a sexist and racist kind mm-hmm. of regime. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have to make those compromises. And I could tell these women they felt isolated insofar as being part of the temple congregation.
Yeah.
But in their homes and in their houses was where they felt like they had the agency, as well as, you know, not being kind of reference of conflict within the temple, to mm-hmm. refashion spirituality and Hinduism in the ways they wanted
yeah.
to. And for a lot of the women, that actually meant maybe not lighting the temple every day. I mean, lighting their lamp every day.
Yeah.
And maybe not taking part in every single festival. And for them, it was actually, I am deeply spiritual, I am Hindu, but mm-hmm. this is how and when and why it works for me.
Then how do you link this to Abhazit Shashni, who then says that, so they, the priests, don't have the powers of getting people employment, but it depends on the karma of the person. That plays a very important role. You are what you are because of the karmic level, right? So everybody has the different stations in life. You can't help that. And that is the whole idea for me, because this is part of faith, this is part of religion, the whole idea that this is karma.
Mm, mm.
And unfortunately, the leaders of the temple have absolutely no role in that, or even fixing that.
Mm. So that was something that I was really struggling with.
Yeah.
Firstly, because I'm not as well versed in Hinduism as the person I interviewed
yes,
was.
Yes, yes.
And secondly, because for me, my first kind of red flag about what she was saying was that if you have endured abuse, or if you've married an abusive person, this has to do with your station in life. It has to do with your karmic debt, or it has to do with a past life.
Mm.
And for me, it feels like you're removing accountability from the abuser. You're,
mm-hmm.
you're kind of saying, oh, well, you were born into this life and into this role, so you should just endure, go through it, and you're paying off your sins you've accrued in your past life.
Doesn't that scare you?
It does scare me. And I did counter her on that
mm-hmm.
because it really presupposes that when abuse happens, when intimate partner violence happens, that this is part of God's plan. That's basically the slippery slope we're leading to. And it's out of the priest's hands to do anything. It's out of the temple's hands to do anything about that. And it also links back to a kind of caste mentality of like everybody has their role in the society. So if you are lower caste, then you would, it's kind of also signaled with morals.
Yeah.
So lower caste, lower morals, etc. And so I felt that thinking bought into a casteist thinking, which is also something I found problematic.
Because then she goes on to say, she also pointed out to other care-based social institutions, such as the Verulam Daycare Center, as the correct place to seek help and care.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, not even a police station.
No.
Don't even seek justice. But in terms of the idea of care, go to this daycare center.
Mm-hmm. And it was really fascinating to me to see how people didn't link care to justice, as you say. It didn't link care to accountability. It just linked care to maybe somebody tapping you on the back or like listening to you talk, so like a counselor per se, which is also important, but so are those other things, like going to a police station, trying to seek some kind of justice for what had happened. So it was really fascinating to see that this is how some people in the temple were conceptualizing
You think that the backyard temples further, further exclude women?
So,
or pushes them away from mainstream?
A little bit about backyard temples, firstly. They kind of are running parallel to temple Hinduism. So I'm thinking of brick and mortar structures that have been going for years. And backyard temples are more informal. Maybe they're in a neighbor's backyard, in a friend's backyard. And it's a smaller congregation as well. And the practices that happen in backyard temples are not necessarily the same things that would happen in temples. I do think, I mean, if we look at, for example, Elaine Diesel's work, she did a lot of really amazing work looking at Aman worship, and Aman is mother. So it's the strand of Hinduism that looks at particularly the mother goddesses, so maybe Durga, Mariamman, Periyachima, there's a whole pantheon of them, and how backyard temples that were women-only spaces would be worshipping the mother. And also, again, like how I spoke about earlier in the kitchen, exchanging advice on how to deal with a really naughty child, or maybe a husband who drinks too much, or maybe something else. So I haven't done research into backyard temples, but I really do think that they could provide some kind of alternative to temple Hinduism, in the sense that it sounds like they're listening to women more.
And I was saying to you earlier on that I thought that backyard temples would just be you as the individual alone. But you mentioned earlier on that no, that's not the case.
I mean, there's many different configurations of it. And I think the fact that it's so informal and decentralized means that it could actually be in your own house, you're doing this thing. And it's just for you and your family. Other times it could be more of a communal thing, and also kind of sporadic. So it's not necessarily meeting up every week, for example. Whereas at the temple, you go every Sunday.
Yolandri, thank you so much for your time. Well done. PhD, quickly.
Lol.
Yeah. We've come to the end of today's conversation and today's show. Thank you guys so much for being part of the conversation.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.